All right, you accursed. Your ever-loving political panel is at full strength once again, which sadly is more than I can say about the Habs. I'm David Hurley with Corey Tenike, Jordan Leichtitz, and Scott Reed, fondly recalling the days of Dryden, Lafleur, Lemaire, Gainey, Scotty, even Rick Chartres, Scott, the only NHLer ever born in Caracas, Venezuela.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
I was last night, I was showing my 10-year-old some old footage of Ken and Patrick Waugh in net. And he was getting very excited because Sam had to play goal yesterday. So he used it as inspiration. Oh.
Yeah. He's not as tall as Ken. All right. Here's the show this week. The Right Honorable Brian Mulroney was kind enough to guest with us on the Hurley Birdie almost 2 years ago. If you haven't heard that interview, it's well worth digging into the pod archives. We'll talk about his legacy and share some stories. Our cursed clipping is from Bill Curry writing in The Globe about conflict of interest and contracting irregularities for the Arrive Can app. Then we'll head west to Corey's in my home province, Saskatchewan's standoff with Ottawa on the carbon tax. And finally, Mr. Pinson will bring our proceedings to a close with our Hey Yous. So, Jordan, Scott, Corey, good weekend. Anything new? Anything exciting?
I was celebrating gender equity in the Galactic Empire on Friday. I went and saw The Empire Strips Back. I'm wearing the T-shirt.
Yes. What's that about?
You know, there used to be no women stormtroopers. Now there are, and they're hot. They dance. They take their tops off. It's crazy. Actually, a very funny show. It's like, I think more vaudeville than striptease. But
finally, a use like, for those stormtroopers.
Like yeah, well, look, I got to relive my childhood obsession with Star Wars in a much more adult fashion. But it was very funny and very good.
Doing everything Anakin Skywalker does, but backwards and in heels, basically.
Yeah, well, they didn't fully address the stuff in like the episode 4 New Hope where it kind of looks like he's dating his sister, which is kind of creepy in retrospect. But they kind of hit all the other highlights.
It's ironic that you look for realism in a show like Star Wars, but the Stormtroopers always ruined that fucking thing for me. Like, I'm not a Star Wars fan, and a big part of it are the Stormtroopers, which is, you know, if we meet an alien empire, they're going to have better warriors than that. Like, they're going to have tougher things than that. It is ridiculous.
And they're all supposed to be, they're all supposed to be based on clones of Boba Fett, but they just march like cordwood toward you and get shot in the head. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Those are clone troopers. Of course, the stormtroopers are the post Clone Wars guys. They're not nearly as hardcore.
I am so here for this
step on your dick there, nerd.
Of nerding out.
Guess which one of us played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons in high school as opposed to dated.
That would be all of you.
Sticking with science fiction, I went to see Dune on Friday night.
How was that?
I loved it.
Okay, I'm excited for that.
I'm going on Thursday.
What if I don't remember the first one?
How can you not?
You have time to recap. You have time to recap.
And you should rewatch it.
Yeah.
All right. They should have brought Sting back, though. He was good in the OG first episode.
There we go. Hey, guys. Brian Mulroney died last week. Sadly. And, it was really interesting to see the outpouring of affection for him from all quarters, it seemed. People were rushing to microphones. Even his longtime dyed-in-the-wool opponents who hated his guts were rushing to microphones to say only positive things about Mr. Mulroney. You'd have been hard-pressed to remember how controversial he was when he was prime minister. How people, it is, people can talk about Polyev or Harper and how Mulroney was a different breed. But, you know, between free trade and Meech Lake, there was a time there when non-conservatives felt like he was destroying the country. Like, it was high stakes stuff, like these fundamental changes that he's now being lauded for were pretty fucking controversial at the time. So it's amazing how that's all come full circle. When I think about him, you guys, I think about him politically, and I think about all the amazing things he did politically, but digging back deep, one of the things that impressed me most was his ability to build alliances to his benefit. So, I mean, everybody's been talking about Reagan and Thatcher, and that's impressive. But I'll give you some tougher hombres to cut a deal with. Peter Lougheed. Peter Lougheed was the Premier of Alberta, along with Bill Davis, the preeminent conservative in the country, did not support Joe Clark in the 1980 federal election campaign, sat it out, didn't hurt Clark in Alberta, obviously, but it certainly damaged his standing nationally. Then you got Bill Davis, who was at that point heading into about the 40th year of consecutive conservative government in Ontario. He was the most powerful politician in Ontario by a mile. He had not supported Clark in 1980, quite conspicuously not supported Clark in 1980. He'd supported Trudeau. And then he had continued to ally himself with Trudeau through the Constitution. And he and Trudeau had a similar political base, moderates. The PC party in Ontario was the centrist party of Ontario back then. The Liberals were more conservative. And then you had Quebec, René Lévesque. So Mulroney convinces Lougheed to support him without making any real public commitments about the hated National Energy Program. He convinces Davis not only to support him, but to throw the entire big blue machine, that 40-year PC juggernaut, behind his efforts in Ontario. And Davis campaigned with Mulroney throughout Ontario. And then there's the last one, René Lévesque. René Lévesque controlled the only political organization in Quebec outside of the Liberal Party, federally and provincially. And he was, if people recall, a separatist. And Mulroney got Lévesque to support him and take what Lévesque called le beau risque of what federalism under Mulroney might be like, and gave up his dream of separating from the country in favor of a looser federalism that Mulroney might negotiate. And so, as compared to Joe Clark, Mulroney went into the 84 election with the full-throated backing of Peter Lougheed in Alberta, Bill Davis in Ontario, and René Lévesque in Quebec. And, I mean, that is something to be able to put together that kind of, and that just speaks to his ability to convince people. I mean, maybe it goes back to his days as a labor negotiator, but where can we find common ground, the two of us, that advances both of our interests? And boy, hard to think of anybody who is better at it than him. Now, Jordan, Mulroney's a little bit before your time. You're a youngin'. I presume you weren't active in politics in the 1990s. So what was going through your head when you heard about Mr. Mulroney's passing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was thinking about the degree to which the Canada that I grew up in is Mulroney's Canada, right? You know, the conditions that he created through free trade, through the failure of the Meech Accord, all of this like really defined my early years, right? You know, if you talk about what really shaped some of the political currents of the 90s. So in that sense, I think that even though his political heyday was when I was a little bit small, he loomed very large in the political environment that has shaped even to where we are today. And, you know, when I think about him, I think about a couple things. I think that his ambition, it was so big, right? His successes and his failures were hugely ambitious and hugely consequential. And you know, as I say, that we live with today. And then, of course, I think like many new Democrats, I think about his international leadership and particularly his work on ending apartheid, which I think we forget today, but required really incredible moral courage, had him breaking from close allies to take that stand. And he did that, but he also, you know, he did other things too that were really significant. You know, he created rights and democracy. He appointed Stephen Lewis to the United Nations. We reached the height of Canada's international aid contribution to GDP under Brian Mulroney, which still hasn't been matched, right? So, you know, he was somebody who saw really a clear role for Canada as a consequential middle power in the world, and then did it and backed that up with action. And I think that there's a blueprint there really across the political spectrum that governments could and should look to in terms of reshaping Canada's role in the international stage to actually punch above our weight, particularly in times like these where we find ourselves sometimes offside with some of our closest allies. And I think there's a lot of important lessons there. Yeah. So really a hugely consequential person and with a legacy that I think is worth talking over.
All right. You know, Corey, if there's anybody that's going to have a negative word to say about Mulroney, it's going to be a reform organizer from Saskatchewan.
Yeah, well, I didn't become one of those until 1996, though.
So, yeah. So Corey's a baby, too.
You've got a closet
too,
full of expensive shoes yourself. So.
Yeah, well, let's just say I'm also a fan of Gucci footwear. But look, I was a Mulroney fan when he was prime minister. And as I say, didn't join the Reform Party till 96. I was sort of a late entrant to that. But, you know, but we should probably talk about that piece a bit, too. Like, I think, you know, and part of what you saw on display with some of the eulogies and remembrances coming out over the weekend was just how many close personal relationships Mulroney was able to forge with people on all sides of the, you know, all complexions of the political spectrum. And when he was prime minister, able to maintain caucus unity at like 8, 9, 10% support in the polls. Like, this is less than half of where Trudeau is today. And we're all on here every day talking about, you know, the threats of coups and, you know, people wanting a leader to leave office when they're prime minister in the mid 20s. Of support. Well, it's less than half of that, and absolute perfect unity within that caucus, which is a feat that I think is unparalleled in politics and speaks to the sort of personal charisma and relationship building power that this man had. I think, you know, in terms of that kind of retail politics, unparalleled skill set of anyone I've ever seen. You know, that said, you know, maybe, like this is the case for most of us, our greatest strengths are our greatest weaknesses as well. And I think had he not had that sort of personal charisma, I always have wondered, you know, would there have been a Reform Party? Would there have been a Bloc Québécois? Was his ability to maintain those personal relationships so strong that it made him and that caucus, you know, impervious to the winds of change that were blowing outside the caucus room? And led to the creation of these parties that, look, for all of the success that the party had, PC party had in the 80s and going into the early 90s, it blew up to the point where, as we all know, they were down to two seats. And, you know, and then for the Conservative Party, basically 15 years in political wilderness at the end of that. But even with that sort of blemish on the political legacy, a lot of the same people, you know, both in Quebec who would have supported the Bloc or out west that supported the Reform Party, almost universally had very kind and charitable things to say about the man, which is once again, I think, a testament to his ability to reach across the aisle, as you were saying, David, and forge relationships and communicate sincerely with people. So, you know, it's a very interesting skill set, you know, well, interesting is the wrong word, really powerful skill set, a really admirable skill set as a politician and I think as just a person.
Let's do a short recap, shall we? We've been talking investment in this space for weeks now on behalf of our presenting sponsor, TELUS. Continual investment, because an innovation economy can't innovate without it. Keep up or die. To wit, the telecom industry invests more than $10 billion annually. That's the third highest level of capital investment per capita in the OECD. The OECD. It's kind of a big deal, Hurley Burleyites. So what does it get us? I mean, beyond faster speeds, broader coverage, and more capacity than most of the rest of the world. Innovation driven by digital connectivity was responsible for almost 20% of Canada's labor productivity growth from 2009 to 2019. That's more here than in the U.S. According to Stats Can, telecommunications generated $48 billion in GDP in 2021, about 2.2% of our national economy. And as we continue to grow the digital economy, our GDP grows with it, an estimated additional $77 billion by 2035. All of this in an environment where prices for wireless products and services have decreased significantly over the last 5 years. Name another thing in your life where prices have decreased lately while quality has gone way up. I'll wait. Anyway, not to put too fine a point on it, but TELUS only wants to continue to invest in ways that support an innovation agenda, improve their offerings, and the lives of Canadians who use them. But as I've been saying, that can only happen under regulatory conditions that make those investments make financial sense. As it stands, we're on the precipice of that not being the case. More next time. Scott, one of my favorite nights in politics was a night in Bill Fox and Bonnie Brownlee, who were very, very close with Brian and Mila and are hurting right now, so my condolences to them. But they had a place in Montreal, and they had me back to their place after some event, and Brian was there. And he was sitting in a chair, and there was a group of us that just sat around on the floor and listened to him tell stories. Holy fuck. It was funny and amazing. He was the best raconteur. I mean, Christ, if I could ever have put together a dinner with him and Turner, what a night that would have been. But the stories between the two of those two guys. But anyway, I know you have your own fond remembrances of Brian Mulroney.
Well, and exactly in the same vein, in that I really, like all of you, and particularly you and Corey, like I admired the raw political skill of the guy, you know, like which I think is really something. To win that smashing 1984 victory, to come off of the depths of unpopularity that he was at and win re-election in 88, all of it. I'd say one thing substantively. It seems to me like a lot of people are going, oh, well, and part of it is, and yes, he was very important. Like you're saying, David, I heard from family this weekend, this past week, because I was, you know, doing commentary on television, talking about his passing and stuff. And I hated that guy. What are you talking about? And I'm like, but you never got a call from him. You never spoke to him. You never got to see him in action. I'm telling you right now, right? The raw political skill of this guy, both in terms of what he could accomplish as a national political figure, but just on an interpersonal one-on-one level, really, really something. People are saying this week, well, you know, we don't see the likes of that anymore. And some of it's code, and some people don't even code it. They say it explicitly, oh, well, we don't have conservatives like that anymore and all this sort of thing. I don't think that's the real thing that we don't have anymore. I think one of the things that's harder and harder to find in political leaders these days, and some of it, at least maybe even a lot of it, owes to people like ourselves, is the extraordinary risks he's willing to take. You know, politics now is so much about risk mitigation and risk management. It's okay, let's not get too far out on this issue, or that issue isn't going to help us. So even though it might be something you feel strongly about, we're going to have to navigate around it and so on and so forth. But for him to go right into the wood chipper, the GST, for him to go right into the incredible risk of free trade, which killed Laurier for Pete's sake in 1911. And then of course, Meech Lake failed. But my God, you get up off the mat from Meech and you go, well, let's try something called Charlottetown then. I mean, there was almost an indefatigable desire and willingness to take great big giant swings. So I think that's something that's missing from our politics these days and it may not come back.
Can I talk about one other thing?
Basically, the GST was, I just want to put a nuance on that. Free trade was a risk, and it was a risk that they miscalculated on and had to recalibrate during the 1988 election campaign in order to win.
Yes.
GST was not a risk. GST was just a decision that we're likely going to lose. We have to do this thing and we're likely going to lose. Bill Fox has told me a story about how at the end of a cabinet discussion on the GST, David Crombie said, you know, we're all going to lose our seats over this, right? And everybody said, yeah, we're all going to lose our seats over this.
Yeah.
So that that wasn't even a risk. That's
hard
a different
to imagine
example.
That today.
No.
I just want to add, you know, David, you tell the story about him sitting around, and I had the pleasure of a few interactions with him as well. And I'll just tell my favorite for a quick second here. It was maybe 10, 15 years ago, and the Conservative government of Harper was working on the negotiation of free trade with Europe. And somebody, I don't know, it might have been somebody even on this call here, this little podcast of ours, somebody was starting to sort of spin on the background of media about how pulling off free trade with Europe for Harper would be a grander accomplishment than free trade with the United States with Mulroney. And so at that time, I had my column and for Post Media. And so I wrote a column saying that, you know, it's important, but it doesn't stand alongside the significance of that. And then so that was written on a Thursday night, printed on a Saturday, and sure enough, Monday morning, ring, ring, there's my phone. Please hold for the Right Honorable Brian Mulroney. And then there's that voice. Scott, is Brian. I wanted to say that this weekend I had the magnificent pleasure of casting my eyes across your outstanding column in that goddamn fucking fish wrap of a newspaper, the Ottawa Citizen. I was quite taken with your incisive, thoughtful observations about my historic achievement in negotiating the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement in spite of implacable, almost insurmountable challenge. You know, Europe is a fine place and full of countries. I congratulate Prime Minister Harper in his efforts to secure a measure of reciprocity with that Tower of Babel. But like you, I could not help but be more astonished at my own accomplishments in reversing nearly 120 years of continental hesitation about our relationship. You know, the talks nearly faltered, very nearly, but a great negotiator understands when to intervene precisely, when to apply that personal touch, the strategic portion of leverage. And when it appeared the Americans were set to walk over the dispute resolution mechanism, which I knew was needed to protect Canada's interests and to keep my friend, the great John Turner, from chewing my ass like I was a secretary's skirt, I applied that leverage. I picked up the phone and I drew upon my close kinship with the towering Ronald Reagan, and I said, Dutch, surely we're not going to let this deal slip from our grasp. This chance to cement an historic handshake of our economies, I urge you, speak with Jim Baker and instruct that limp dick Peter fucking Murphy to give your Canadian cousins this small concession. It worked. I triumphed, and as you so correctly captured in your flowing lyrical prose, all of Canada triumphed also. Scott, I want to congratulate you and your fine work and superior grasp of our national story. My best to your family. Please say hello to Paul for me and tell Hurley to cut his fucking hair.
All right. Well done. Well, that's, well done. Man,
right, well done. I loved him. I loved him. He was just something. He was a force of nature.
Can I add one more thing before we move on? Because I think we'd be remiss not to talk for at least a few seconds about the Airbus stuff, because it's sort of an obvious blemish on his record. But I'd like to say this, that I think not just for people in politics, but all of us in life too, we're all better than our worst moments. And, you know, whatever that was, you know, it was obviously a mistake. And I think he, you know, would be someone who would acknowledge that as well. But I think his ability to have picked himself up from that and have the sort of support that he's had subsequent to that speaks to what, at least for me in my personal experience, is the true test of his character and demonstration of his character. I think he was a good man, and I think if you meet any of his family, like, they're wonderful people, and the loyalty and affection that all of us, I think here, but especially the three of us that knew him, is genuine. I think he was a really good person, and I think he'll be missed.
Yeah, he's a great man. And all three titans that fought the 84 and 88 election campaigns are now gone. Brian, John, and Ed. And sometime in the next year and a half or two, when there's a leaders debate in a federal election campaign, and I'm watching Justin Trudeau, Pierre Poilievre, and Jagmeet Singh, I will think of Brian, John, and Ed and just weep a little bit for my country. So, last month, without trumpets or drums, as the French say, our sponsor CN set a record. It moved more Canadian grain out of Western Canada than any other February in Canadian history. This was just the latest in a string of broken records. Now, some of the railway's detractors will get up on their hind legs and say, well, let's not forget February 2024 had 29 days, not 28. True. But here's the thing. CN beat the record in 28, didn't need 29. Others will complain that, well, we are in the middle of the first El Nino since 2016, which brings warmer weather, which makes it easier to haul freight in January. True, but please, railways don't set records because of intermittently unseasonal weather resulting from warmer water in the Pacific. CN has been on a record-breaking streak because it has changed the execution of its mission, which is to haul its customers' cargo safely and smoothly and efficiently. In the past few years, the railway has gotten back to a crucial basic, punctuality. CN trains now leave the station on time, every time, or the boss will want to know why. As I have said here before, that's not as simple as it sounds. It means razor-sharp scheduling on a busy network that spans North America east to west and deep into the south. It means ensuring tracks are clear and that trains don't sit for hours during station stops. Rigid insistence on sticking precisely to schedules provides crucial certainty for shippers and customers. They get the space they need for their cargo when they need it, and they can be certain it will arrive on time. That's a big deal, and it sets records. Oh, incidentally, expert forecasters are saying El Nino will almost certainly transform in a few months into El Nina, the sister system to El Nino. La Nina cools the Pacific and creates a whole different set of weather issues. CN is aware, and it will be ready. All right, let's move on to news of the day. News of the day. The governance of the country continues such as it is. Our clipping today comes from Bill Murray. Bill Curry, not Bill Murray. If it came from Bill Murray, it would be funny.
That would be great.
Yeah, it would be great.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Fuck, I wish we had a clipping from Bill Murray. But anyway, we have a clipping from Bill Curry. And he's a more serious man. And Bill Curry says, Treasury Board President Anita Anand said the federal government is suspending all contracts with Dalian Enterprises, a private business that received millions of dollars to work on the ArriveCan app, while its president has been working simultaneously as a public servant. Auditor General Karen Hogan recently reported that she found a disregard for basic management practices as the cost of the app for international travelers grew to about $59.5 million. Her report found two-person IT staffing company GC Strategies received $19 million, and Dalian, which has also said it has just two employees, received $7.9 million. Ms. Anand, who was procurement minister at the onset of the pandemic and defense minister from the fall of 2021 until the summer of 2023, said she didn't know that Dalian president and founder David Yeo is also a federal public servant with the Department of National Defense. It says to me that there's no accountability, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre told reporters. Now that we know this, this individual should be immediately fired, and there should be an immediate police investigation of his conduct and that of the company with which he's associated, and a broader inquiry within the public service of how this contracting was allowed to go on for so long. In question period, NDP leader Jagmeet Singh said that with ArriveCan, the drama never stops. He pointed out that his party has long called for more IT work to be done in-house by public servants. So what? In any event, Scott, ever since we've been doing this show, we've been saying one of the rules of crisis management is you say, okay, what are people ever going to know about this? What's ever going to come out about it? What is all the stuff? Let's get our inventory and let's get it out now and deal with it. So this is like rule one. This is not something you're supposed to hire high-powered professionals to advise you to do. This is something everybody is supposed to fucking know. So how are they still finding out new things like this at this juncture?
Well, that rule supposes that you know everything and therefore can rush to the end of it. And you're left only with the uncomfortable decision of whether or not you're going to take that upon yourself and manage it. When you don't know, you're just even that many more times vulnerable. And that clearly is what's happening here. And I'll add this. This is such a painful circumstance if you're in government, and it could happen to anybody. But of course, it has to happen to the Trudeau guys just at their 20 points in the polls, and they're already faltering. It just fits so, like, you know, I said this the other day, like sometimes when you're this low in the polls, when you walk outside, it just rains wherever you fucking go. And that just feels like it. If you look at Anita Anand, you mentioned the column, you talk about Bill's column, but if you looked at the headline of it, the headline was she was quote unquote extremely surprised to learn that this guy was, you know, not just a contractor, but also full time. Highlights how impossible it is to manage this situation. If she doesn't say, she saying extremely surprised is a mistake. It's a mistake because it's bound to be the lead in the headline, which then opens you up to the allegation. And well, you fucking clowns don't even know what's going on. You piss money away so constantly and so easily and so casually that you don't even know that this kind of thing occurs. So you get that allegation. If you don't acknowledge, obviously, that you were unaware of this, well, then it suggests that you must be complicit, which is not true, and you can't say. So you're just dancing on the head of a pin, and you're relying upon a public service that obviously in this case has permitted this to occur. Somebody, some criminal entrepreneur or alleged criminal entrepreneur, understood that the system was so porous that he could actually set himself up in this way and just bilk all these contracts. So you're not going to get a quick brief. You're not going to get a reliable brief. You're sitting there as a minister going, I'm about to go outside, face the newspapers and the microphones.
Wait a second. I think the guy's employment status was on his LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, I think
it was on his LinkedIn profile.
Well, okay. He also wasn't exactly unprominent. The guy ran for the People's Party last campaign.
Well, yeah, but it's easy for you guys to say that. Was anybody else reporting that before? It's just a fucking mess. There's nothing you can do. You're just going to have to take it in the teeth. There's nothing you can do. All you can do is decide how much you bring the temperature up versus how much you try to bring it down.
My bullshit detector is hitting red alert status right now. Like,
well, Corey, where were you? Really? Were you so talking about this 6 weeks ago, saying that this guy existed?
No. Okay. So, look, I'm not doing a political staff work in Ottawa for the Liberal Party. People will be shocked to learn. But I've done this kind of work before for other governments. And I got to say, when all of the answers are open source available to you, this guy fucking testified about this. He's beyond everyone's radar who's looking at it. And the media obviously found it through open source. This isn't some, you know, hidden A-tip. It's as David correctly pointed out, on his fucking LinkedIn profile. So like this is not something that is impossible to find. This is sloppy political work. It's sloppy work on the part of the department. And now, you know, if you do sloppy work long enough, you're going to pay a political price. And so, you know, if you're looking where the intersection is with politics and the elected government, it's grotesque fucking incompetence at the very least. Like, it is a violation of all the principles of issues management and crisis management. It's a violation of just basic due diligence once an issue is being raised, to actually go in and do the absolute basic research to find out what's going on. And it's not like this is new. This has been dragging on for over a year. Like, how lazy and fucking inept do you have to be to get a political staff job in Ottawa for this government? Apparently quite fucking lazy and quite fucking inept. Because this is just a tour de force of ineptitude.
Can I just follow up with you on that? Just as an interesting sidebar, because, you know, you've been in a long government. What would you say about the kind of people that work in ministers' offices in year 9 of the government compared to year 1?
Well, you're generally dealing with like your third or fourth generation of staff. And, you know, but on some of these things, I don't think that's an excuse, David. Like, you know, there a lot of people spend a lot of time training political staff, and this is sort of such crisis and communications 101 stuff that there is really no excuse. Like, the only reason that you don't look for this is, you know, there's something stinky and you don't want to find it, and you think you're going to be able to whistle past the graveyard, but you never can, not on something this big. And you call it grotesque incompetence, call it political malpractice, call it whatever you want, but it's going to be a case study of how not to do this and a cautionary tale for other people in politics as to what happens when you don't do your fucking job.
Ontario is now celebrating 10 years of being coal-free, having burned its last piece of coal in 2014 and becoming the first jurisdiction in North America to fully eliminate coal-fired electricity. This was touted as the single largest GHG reduction initiative in North America, eliminating more than 30 megatons of annual GHG emissions, equivalent to taking 7 million vehicles off the road. Also, 2014 was the first time since Ontario's air quality monitoring program began in 1993 that no smog advisories were issued in the province, a feat accomplished many times over in the 10 years since. What people may not be aware of is how Ontario phased out coal, while still maintaining a reliable and affordable electricity grid for homes, businesses, and hospitals in Ontario. So let me shed a little smog-free light on that. Today's podcast sponsor, Bruce Power, is a nuclear generating facility in Tiverton, Ontario, that currently supplies about 30% of Ontario's electricity. When Bruce Power restarted four of its eight nuclear units between 2003 and 2012, after being shut down in the 1990s, it provided 70% of the generation required to phase out coal. As nuclear power increased and displaced coal-fired electricity, Ontario's carbon emissions decreased. In short, nuclear up, smog down. Fast forward 10 years later, Bruce Power is continuing to invest in its nuclear generating units to ensure a clean, reliable supply of electricity for decades to come, which will be vital in supporting Canada's climate goals. Jordan, let me read to you what Polyev said again. Now that we know this, this individual should be immediately fired, and there should be an immediate police investigation of his conduct and that of the company with which he's associated, and a broader inquiry within the public service of how this contracting was allowed to go on for so long. What part of that's wrong?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing is wrong with it. And I think, I would add to Corey's rather scathing, tough but fair critique, I think, of the issues management performance on this to say that it is not a surprise that there are skeletons in the closet on consulting. This government has faced that before. Like it was less than a year ago that they shat the bed with the McKinsey stuff. So when you know that there's a problem, when you know that we have found issues around consulting over reliance, be they legal issues and what appears to be straight out fraud, as we see in this instance, or just political problems with huge, huge expensive over-reliance on unnecessary contracting out, then you should be looking top to bottom in every department and rooting that stuff out so that you can get ahead of it. Now, I agree with Scott that likely ministerial offices are not getting the full story at this point, and that is a bigger, broader issue. But that's also something that you were likely, you know, you could see that on the horizon well over a year ago when these issues really first came to the fore. So I don't think that there's much excuse for them to be completely ambushed by what is effectively a known problem. This is like a variation on a theme here at this point. And the issue now, I think, for the government is that, well, it is not a political scandal in the sense that it's not tied, like we have no evidence that anybody at the political level has benefited from this or was even aware of it. You have the problem of appearing incompetent for not knowing about this and for not having a handle on it and for now being daily ambushed. Like, I'll note that there was even, you guys likely saw, half of you were on it, the CTV question period. They had one of the subcontracted companies out there yesterday saying, "We blew the whistle at CBSA." You know, so
that interview was mind-blowing.
Stunning. Well, like, it was stunning, right?
But those accusations, and even from those individuals who've been in the media before, like,
exactly.
At what point do you actually sit down and say, "Hey, maybe what they said is true. Maybe we should go look there." Like, they drew a fucking map.
Yeah.
As to what the problem was and where it was.
And here's I'm just going to come back to the communications problem government has. It goes to what Polyev was saying. Polyev is proposing an action there. Call the fucking cops, okay? Right now, the government, their strategy on managing this issue has largely been to step back and try to duck as outside investigations are going past on this. And I think that maybe 2 weeks ago, that was a defensible strategy. I think now there is definitely an advantage in coming out and being the one to take action, to call for deeper investigation, to call for criminal probes in some of these instances, in order to look like this isn't just something that's being done to you, because that's what's happening right now. And I think when you're a government,
they're already late to that, though.
They're late to that. But it's, you know, you could do it early this week and it would maybe help. Here's the issue, right? When you're a government that has a reputation for apologizing for everything, and to be clear, I think that there are many things that they've apologized for that it is right and good that they apologize for.
They don't apologize for anything they do.
But that's exactly it. They never apologize for anything they do. And so there's a risk that in the minds of voters, this gets mixed in with stuff like the Aga Khan trip, like the, you know, all of the ethics scandals that the Prime Minister has been implicated in. This just becomes another brick in the wall on that. And that is the absolute last thing that they need right now. And then a last word on Anita Anand, because I think, you know, the headline was so unfortunate. Like, that was a terrible clip. You can't come out and say that you're surprised about this. It is your whole fucking job to not be surprised. And I actually think, I find Anita Anand very competent. And so I think she's getting bad comms advice on that. It's not good enough. And they have to go back to the drawing board on that, because she could be a very helpful person in terms of solving this political problem for the government. But you have to use her better than that.
She kind of looks competent.
She is competent.
But she was the minister at DND when this, like she's at Treasury Board now, but she was at DND where this employee was, and a bunch of the contracts were with her.
Well, in fairness, she might have been at procurement.
Yeah. Well, so even worse. But, like, you know, and Bill Blair earlier on, like, oh, I don't know, I just work here. I'm just the boss.
I do not expect better from Bill Blair, but I do expect better from Anita.
Scott, I want to loop back around to you and ask you something that kind of percolates in the back of my mind when I watch this happen, which is...
I'll bet $1,000 I know what you're going to ask.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, we'll see. My question is this. So everybody in Canada, according to the polling, knows that the Conservatives are going to win the next election. That includes all of the people who are public servants in Ottawa. All know that the Conservatives are going to win the next election. What is happening right now to the relationship between the government and the public service?
Well, that's not exactly what I thought you were going to ask. But your question's more interesting, I suppose. Look, it's foolish to pretend that it doesn't have an effect. It has a warping impact on relationships. And, you know, people... are careerists and they're ambitious in the public service, right? And so they're like, okay, how do I not get any more of me on me, any more of this on me, as this government sort of feels like it's, staggering toward the finish line? And how do I make certain that I position myself well for the next regime? Not in a partisan way, but in a careerist way, right? So that I'm not tainted and I'm not sort of strategically set aside because I was too closely aligned with that previous government and all that sort of stuff. So I think it has a warping effect on that. I don't think that people literally sit on information. I don't think they try to frustrate or harm. I think they make diligent efforts. But I also just think that sometimes the senior public service begins to reflect the government for whom they work, and they become just as tired and just as set in their ways. Well, Minister, you know, we will try, but understand these are limitations. And it just feels mailed in. And I think that, as much as anything, is what's going on, you know. And there's just not, when you're part of a new government, there's an insurgent mentality that takes over the government and that infects anything and everything around it. And that includes the public service and the senior public service. People have a fire lit under their ass. Now it's more like people staggering toward their bus in the morning with a donut and a coffee, thinking what fresh hell awaits. That's the problem.
Can I give you a different take on that same question?
Yeah. Because, I mean, Corey, it's an interesting situation we're in that's unusual, because we know for a certainty what the result of the next election is, but that election's not likely for a year and a half. So that's a very long run to have a government in place that you know is going to lose. And it puts the public service in an odd spot.
Well, you start getting into internal cover-up within the bureaucracy as well, of people trying to cover their ass for things that are not altogether good. And look, at the end of the day, this is becoming a scandal of political incompetence. But the actual source crime and source illness here is a cancer within the public service around some of these programs that they created. And in fact, apparently, this shady guy, this grifter, helped create the Aboriginal-owned business program and procurement policies, which he then went on from helping to create to figure out a way to benefit himself to the tune of millions of dollars. So that is a failure of internal controls and things that are really the sole domain of
Buffy St. Marie's IT public company.
Yeah, right, exactly. Mm. So, yeah. Like, look, I think there is a bunch of ass covering going on inside the federal public service, and probably with really good reason, because, you know, this thing stinks to high heaven. I don't think this is the only two companies that are involved in this. And I think an audit of these programs is going to be a treasure trove of malfeasance and broken protocols and grifting, because that's what it is. It's grifting. This is, you know, and if I were someone in the First Nations who had a truly Aboriginal owned business and saw this, I would be livid, because this is just fakery to the nth degree. You know, where you're subcontracting out all of the work, and this isn't helping Aboriginal communities.
And this is an issue that's been identified by Indigenous companies. So that, right. They were aware that this is a risk,
and blowing the whistle on. But it looks to me, from, you know, casual observance, is meeting the stats on 5% or 3%, whatever the number is, of contracts going to First Nations business was more important than it actually going to First Nations business. And so I think the public service played along in this fakery at many different levels. And I think it's going to reach up to deputy minister level people. And those people are the ones who don't want to see their career end most of all. And they're hiding it. And all the more reason why political staff have to actually get up in the morning, get a cup of coffee, go into the office and do their fucking job.
Jordan, you got anything to close off with?
Well, I mean, hopefully this will also be a catalyst to put an end to the notion that it is always more efficient to contract out, that we never have the skills within the public service, because clearly we fucking do. They're sitting there, the guy that you contracted out to is sitting there working in D&D. So there is
Jordan,
an issue.
Jordan, if you didn't have the skills in the public service for this, how about among the 50,000 people you've hired?
Right?
Right? Maybe you could have found those skills among the 50,000 people you've hired.
Exactly. So I think that there is an issue of over-reliance on contracting that is creating the opportunity for these things to happen that has to be dealt with at a cultural level in Ottawa, where there's this reflexive notion that it's always better and cheaper and easier to contract out. And there just needs to be investment in upskilling within the public service and using the people that we have in a better way to do this work. It is absolutely possible to create an app within government. This should be something that we can do.
The federal government is betting big on EV batteries as a way to urgently reduce emissions. What many Canadians don't realize is that the sudden explosion in battery manufacturing projects is built on decades of research at Dalhousie University in Halifax. Jeff Don's work, starting back in the 1990s, helped pioneer lithium-ion batteries. Jeff and his team have forged industrial partnerships, working to advance batteries that are increasingly efficient. Since 2016, Jeff has held the NSERC Tesla Canada Industrial Research Chair. Now an entire network of students from his lab are deploying their expertise and experience with a leading electric vehicle manufacturer across Canada, positioning us at the forefront of a rapidly growing sector. Investing in research can help fight climate change. That's why U15 Canada is a proud member of the Coalition for Canadian Research, The coalition is urging the federal government to support science and talented Canadian researchers with new funding this budget. We have to support Canadian ambition, full stop. Visit researchcoalition.ca to learn more. Let's move on to our last topic for the day, which comes from the Home Office, Corey. Home Office in Prelate, Saskatchewan. What we have
I thought it was in Yonge, but okay.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, yeah. I think the Yonge office is more functional and operational at this point. So the minute that the Trudeau government exempted home heating oil from the carbon tax, the premier of Saskatchewan said, well, we want the same thing for Saskatchewan, for natural gas, for home heating. And the federal government said, that's it. We're not making any more changes. This thing in Atlantic Canada was our last change to this. Guilbeau said, there'll be no change as long as I'm the minister after this. So that was the official federal position. So Mo says, well, then we're not going to collect the carbon tax in Saskatchewan on natural gas. And everybody assumes he's joking because it's a violation of the law. The carbon tax has been confirmed by the Supreme Court as a viable law in the country. So, but here they are, they're doing it. They are not remitting the carbon tax to Ottawa. And the federal response, again, they had time to think about this. The federal response seemed to me to be confused because the first response out of Minister Wilkinson was that that ends the rebate for Saskatchewan. But of course, it probably doesn't end the whole rebate for Saskatchewan because they're still paying the carbon tax in other ways, just not on natural gas. And so now there's some different signals being sent out of Ottawa or whether that means part of the rebate's canceled or the rebate. I think one of the things that's interesting is that the pushback from the feds has actually nothing to do with climate or the efficacy of the carbon tax and everything to do with the rebate and whether or not you will lose the rebate and be worse off from an affordability standpoint, not from a climate standpoint. So this is now not even a climate fight. This is a what's better for your pocketbook fight between the two levels of government. Corey, I'm going to start with you. Where does this go from here? And if the feds don't force Saskatchewan to collect this tax, will it end there, or does the whole carbon tax regime crumble after that?
Well, it's the whole carbon tax regime on the consumer side is going to crumble after the next election, and it's very clear that's where it's going. Like, this thing has hemorrhaged political support across the country with basically every demo, with provincial parties of every stripe, and it's as obvious as a nose on your face that this thing's going to be gone after the next election. And you know what else is going on? I think you know, provincial electoral politics as usual. Saskatchewan's going into a campaign. This is a great issue for them to fight on. They're going to fight on it, and they're going to outlast the Trudeau government and ultimately get their way. And I don't think there'll be any consequence for Saskatchewan other than Scott Moe's going to get reelected with a massive majority if this is what the ballot question is.
How does it not become irresistible politics for Ford? If Mo can get away with this, how does it not become irresistible for everybody else?
It's a little more difficult on the natural gas non-remittance side for the province of Ontario than it is for a province that has their own gas company. So it's, you know, I think there's some technical reasons why not, but I think
that's interesting.
I think rhetorically, I don't think there's a huge difference. You know, Ford has been out saying that natural gas should be exempted as well. And he's not alone. Like, you know, there's a lot of shit that's being talked on this podcast about Danielle Smith, but on this issue, she is 100% right too. And like, what does it look like? It looks like very crass regional political gamesmanship on the part of the federal government to have done the exemption on home heating fuel to begin with. You know, a fuel that, you know, is used to heat most homes in only one region where they have a big political problem and they had a big problem in their caucus. And so they solved the problem by exempting them. And be damned what that does to anyone else in the country. Be damned. Like, it's, you know, it's so indefensible from a public policy point of view And I think so divisive in a country that has, you know, constant fault lines that responsible leaders have to be trying to repair and to mend around rural-urban divides, around regional divides within the country. Instead of, you know, trying to fill those cracks and you know, they're drilling holes in them and packing them with explosives. Like, it's just bad for Canada. You know, it's just bad. And you know, I don't think that Scott Moe is alone in his concerns about this. I think it's constitutional overreach what they're doing. I think many provinces would agree with that. And I think ultimately the Supreme Court will agree with that too. They already have once in looking at their impact analysis approach on the environmental side. And I'll say more on my Hey You, but you know, Stephen Guibeau is, you know, like absolutely destructive force in terms of Canadian politics right now. And some of the things he's saying and some of the things he's doing. And I don't think, it may be illegal for Scott Moe not to remit these taxes. I think that's probably the right answer from a legal perspective. But I think it's also illegal what the federal government's trying to do from a constitutional perspective around overreaching into provincial jurisdiction and things like this. There is no way in hell that provinces like Saskatchewan and Manitoba can do what the federal government is trying to force them to do with their power grids in the timeline that they've put forward. Like, there's none. And so, you know, why are you doing that other than to try to punish a region that doesn't support you? And, you know, when asked about this, I forget which dumbass MP said, well, you should, it was a cabinet minister in Alberta.
It was Goody Hutchings.
Who said that, you know, you should vote for more liberals. Okay. Is that your final answer?
Because that's sort of the same answer as Guilbeault's, which is not going to happen. So,
yeah. People like to say that he doesn't threaten to leave cabinet when he doesn't get his way. But what is saying that that'll never happen as long as I'm minister, other than an ultimatum?
Watching my beloved Riders, I've learned that good passing and player development were keys to long-term success. When politicians pass blame to municipalities, when we don't develop communities with investments in infrastructure, that hurts growth. No one wins. Municipalities are community builders. They need a game plan from Ottawa for more infrastructure investments and a better funding model to ensure Canadians' quality of life. They need both now in Budget 2024. The Federation of Canadian Municipalities represents cities, towns, and villages ready to build more housing across the country. They need the federal government to step up and support the infrastructure and services those houses will need to become complete communities. Without that support, fewer new homes get built, existing quality of life suffers, and growth across Canada stalls. Municipal, provincial, and federal governments all want growth. Let's make sure that growth is supported with the infrastructure, parks, services, and transit to develop new housing into new Canadian communities now and in the future. Let's win as a team. Scott, how do you see the players lined up on the chessboard here?
It's just a nightmare. I mean, all of this is the consequence of true incoherence around the carbon tax and its application and, you know, exempting natural gas, Atlantic Canada. So all these things start to fall. I guess the one thought, I mean, the last place you want to fight right now, if you're the federal government, is on the carbon tax. On the other hand, you're in this thing. So now what? You're going to get the worst of all possible worlds. That's almost always how these guys play it, right? Like, let's make certain that we plant ourselves crotch first, firmly on the top of the fence, and just split ourselves wide open. And so I think if you're going to go, you might as well go hard and try to make it. Listen, you don't get to pick and choose which fucking laws you follow. And that's just the way it goes. And you know what? Someone's got to speak for the national interest and try to make it less about the carbon tax and more about fundamental respect for the rule of law. And if we're going to pass laws in our parliament, then they're going to be respected, and try to win that fight. I know you're not going to win it in Saskatchewan. You're not going to win it in whole large chunks of the country and with whole large portions of the demographic. But rather than losing this thing 90-10, maybe try to lose it 70-30. See, like, since you're at 25, anything better than 25 is a fucking percentage margin victory. So I guess I'd try to make those arguments, Marshall, those arguments, play it tough, be a little Pierre Trudeau on this and go, listen, motherfucker, right? Like, there's actually, like, there's a national imperative here. There are federal laws, there are national laws, and there's a national federal parliament, and we're going to respect it. And try to see if you can gain some benefit out of that argument. I hate it because it's all, frankly, flows from your own half-assery around the exemption, but they can't, there's like, they're not getting out of this thing, so they might as well fight for some benefit, some gain, somehow.
I'm just going to stick with you for a second, Scott. I'm just going to continue to be amazed by things of this government. And I feel bad because we talked about Anita Anand in the previous section, and I like Anita Anand, and I think she's good. And now we're talking about Jonathan Wilkinson, and I like Jonathan Wilkinson, and I think there's lots of strengths to him too. But how the fuck is it possible that he looked like surprised, unready for the Saskatchewan government announcement? How is it possible that he's not been sitting around with his senior people and the prime minister in the prime minister's office and Dominic LeBlanc as intergovernmental or whoever's intergovernmental and figuring out how we're going to manage this national unity situation and this intergovernmental situation that has both massive substantive components to it and political components to it? Like, I would have thought the second Saskatchewan made its move, the feds would be ready with a strategy to fight back. Yet it seemed to be that they didn't really know what their position was.
You would have thought. But that is not where they are. Listen, I'm like you. I don't like to, I feel badly about every week I come on here and just kick the living shit out of a government that feels like it's laying on its side. But it is on this, over and over and over again, we see this point made, which is problems that should be predictable and therefore merit some prepared response and strategy appear to be ignored until the doorbell rings, the prime minister flings open the door, and there's a flaming bag of shit on his front step, and he goes, oh, 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 and starts stamping it out. And you're like, oh my God, I fell for this again, those fucking kids. And that's just the way it seems to work.
Jordan?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, I mean, this is really bad. And I think, look.
By the way, the Saskatchewan NDP also opposed the carbon tax.
And that's right.
Also
well, think it should I wanted not apply to that. Natural I wanted gas. To get to that.
Their criticism of Mo is that he should have done what the Atlantic
right.
people
take
did.
Yeah, that's right. That you should be the gas tax suspension. And so I mean, I think on that point, you know, I'm not really sure that the domestic within Saskatchewan political benefit that Mo's going to get out of this is actually super huge or super clean. I mean, look, he's in real trouble. And the last poll out actually had the NDP passing him in popular vote. The government looks and feels tired. They've been distracted. Criminal charges for ministers. Mo spending $1 million.
He's not in real trouble unless I see some evidence that anybody in rural Saskatchewan is going to vote against the government.
That was a fake poll, too, by the way.
Oh, a fake poll.
It is. Like it's a teachers' union poll.
But even if it's true, they can't win on those numbers. But anyway, let's move ahead.
But you know, a few more points, and you start talking about running the table in Regina. You start getting into numbers that get a little more interesting, and then more things become possible. So look, anyway, we're going to have that debate, I think, a lot of times before the fall. But
look, I'm not unsympathetic, Jordan.
Yes, I feel you. So I think for the government here, the Liberals, this is entirely a predictable problem, really of their own making. There was only one way that Scott Moe was going to react to an inequitable change on the carbon tax front, and it was with his whole chin, and that's exactly what's occurred. I think it is really, you know, just as a person interested in the rule of law, it's a pretty big problem if you have a province that just decides to opt out of a law, whether they like it or not. Like, the carbon tax is a debatable policy point, but following legislation is really not. And so I think that they are missing an opportunity to actually go out on what is a little bit more of a solid ground. The federal response was, as others have spoken to, it seemed weak. It seemed confused. It's not clear what the implications are going to be for the rebate, and ergo, it's not clear what this decision actually means for the people of Saskatchewan. Therefore, no one has any stakes in it, really, other than the Liberal government here in Ottawa and Scott Moe. So I don't think it was handled well. I think it was very predictable. I don't like the tactic from Moe, but I think it was one that he was fairly obviously going to choose. And I do think that it, not having any consequences really coming from the federal government clearly about this will make me completely unsurprised to see Danielle Smith perhaps want to go down this road as well. And I like that Corey's like, if you might have looked into it in Ontario, it's pretty complicated, So we may not see Ford follow that path, but others will. And this is bad for the country. So this is something that I think that they could have done a much cleaner job on, and it was clear that it was coming a mile away. But it really does underscore the idea that it was impossible. The political proposition that they thought that they were making in cutting a deal with their Atlantic caucus, that they could somehow contain that in a bubble and that it wouldn't kind of infect the rest of the program is not real.
It's the original sin of this.
That's it. And there was never going to be any ability to come back from that. So, but again, instead of managing that head on and negotiating some sort of other compromise around that for other regions that would actually give them some political benefit where they could take credit, again, they are just reacting and they're letting things happen to them. So I think it was very poorly managed. But as I said, I remain unconvinced that this is going to necessarily be a huge boost for Scott Moe. It still is not at all clear that this is going to turn around momentum for him on this. He's still having a pretty rough ride right now.
Well, I don't know that it's as important to people in Saskatchewan right now as the teacher strike.
That's right. Exactly.
All right. I think it's time for Hey Yous.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
Who's got one? Corey, you look like you're ready. You look like you're ready.
I am, and it bleeds into what we just talked about. So my Hey You is for the Prime Minister and his team. You are not going to win the next election if you are fighting with everyone on carbon tax, and they may not want to change, but they do need to start landing some of these planes on things like their electricity regulations, and if they want to hit any of their carbon reduction targets, they need to get a deal with Alberta on carbon capture and storage. There are a bunch of planes they got to land that are going to require really astute negotiating, the kind that Brian Mulroney could have perhaps offered. And I don't think an absolutist, radical ideologue like Stephen Guilbeault is the guy that you put into those negotiations with provinces. He can't do that job, in my view. He is his credibility is burned. His interpersonal relationships, I think, even with their own cabinet, are so frayed as to be completely ineffective. I think they need a Dom LeBlanc, or they need a Wilkinson, or someone like that who actually has a demonstrated ability to maintain relationships with provinces and work with parties and leaders that don't entirely agree with their agenda, and come up with some compromise. And not just for their own political benefit, but for the benefit of the country. Like, at the end of the day, I do think that the Prime Minister, although we disagree on many things, does want to leave the place in a better way than he found it. I'm not sure that's possible right now, but you can at least make efforts in that direction. And so, for the love of God, get Guilbeault out of this position and get somebody in there who can work with others and try to find compromise and try to de-escalate some of these situations in a way that not only improves your political fortunes, but does the right thing for the country as a whole.
There you go. All right, Jordan?
So my Hey You this week is going out to a friend and former colleague of mine, George Smith, who up until Friday was the Director of Communications for Premier Eby, and before that, Premier Horgan. And so George is a great human and a very skilled Director of Communications, has amazing ability, relationships with media, great sense of humor when you're in the shit. And I think his work really shines when you see some of the difficult things those governments have navigated. And I just wanted to thank him for his service and wish him a good time actually seeing his family.
There we go. Scott?
You know, all the pods that we've done recently, maybe the most feedback I've had, at least in the last year or so, was our discussion around media and the state of media a couple of weeks back. And a lot of people expressing distress about where media is at and how things are going to unfold and what it implies for the strength of our democratic tradition and all that. And so in that context, my hey you goes out to Mark Critch, because as a bona fide star at CBC and a guy I know and really like, I just want to call out the courage that he showed this past week. I really believe that the CBC is more important now than ever. Like, it's as a national institution that provides local news, that actually has editorial standards and people bitch and moan about it, right? I think it's really important. And I think it's therefore extraordinarily important that the CBC be good, that its leadership be good, that it be sharp, that it be effective, that it knows where it wants to go and it knows how it's going to navigate these perilous times, because it fucking matters and we're really counting on you. And so when Catherine Tate, as the president, just absolutely runs into the brick wall of salary bonuses and just seems to fumble every ball that's thrown anywhere near her on the field, I just get enraged, because I feel that she's blowing something that matters so much. And Critch deserves the hey you, because as a star on CBC, he did not mince his words. And when he was asked about this issue recently, he said, quote, "If it's taxpayers' money, I don't think anybody should be getting a bonus really for anything unless they completely save the day. Like, if somebody came up with a cure for COVID, give that person a bonus." That was Mark's comment. And I can tell you, as somebody that works for a media organization, it's not always easy to stand up and say, my bosses are shitting the bed. So good on Mark Critch, and God damn it, Catherine Tate and the leadership of the CBC, you need to be better. Because if you fuck this up, you fuck something up really big.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of hope for that to happen. But good one. My hey you goes out to Ontario Liberal leader Bonnie Crombie. You fucked up the carbon tax question, and you're going to need to fix it. Like, why the fuck would you want to be the last person in the country defending the carbon tax? Like, after the next federal election, there will be nobody. It's over. And so you should get on the right side of that. And I don't think that you need to worry about internal politics in the Liberal Party. I think that Liberals will be fine if you cut the consumer portion of the carbon tax loose and get in a position to win a provincial election. So do not worry about internal harmony on an issue that is this bad. Just get to the right side of it and do it quickly. All right, folks, that is our show for today. I want to thank our intrepid panel of Scott and Jordan and Corey for their work today. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsors, CN, Bruce Power, U15 Canada, and the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. Thank you all for your support, and I want to thank all of you who watched or listened today. Hope you enjoyed yourselves, and we will be back next week with more of The Curse of Politics. Until then, take care of yourselves. Thank you.